Thank you, Phil. So I should introduce myself. I forgot at the beginning. My name is Zachary Bakke. I'm the Knowledge Management Specialist for the Bureau for Food Security. We're going to open it now for questions. As we're going to take questions from in-person and online, kind of alternating. And as I said, if you can ask your question and then state your name and organization, then ask your question, that would be great. Thank you. With that, open it up.
Oh, thank you.
Testing.
Ahmed Kaplan.
Mm-hmm. Testing, testing.
Ahmed Kaplan, USAID Feed the Future. Question for John regarding the Tanzania Tuberoshe food fortification project. How is that? How do you work that to ensure there is no post-harvest loss? Because from what you described, it is a food fortification after harvesting, but I did not see the linkage between it and the post-harvest loss. And question for Philip regarding the hermitage storage. I assume because you showed them for indoor and outdoor, they are water resistant, so water will not get into them.
So I think the post-harvest loss aspect of that project is they're introducing much more efficient small-scale milling processes, so they get a higher yield in the first place of the milled grain. Secondarily, but just as importantly, then they're working with the millers. In our Feed the Future concern for improved nutrition, they're incorporating micronutrients at the level of these mills to fortify the flour that results from the milling process, and they're doing this through and I don't know all the details about the project, but they're actually working with if there's anybody here from the health community, these sprinkles packets of combined micronutrients that you can fortify various food products with. So it's better yields through better milling technologies, and then improvement of post-harvest quality through the addition of the micronutrients. It's led by a contractor. It's a pretty big project. It's a standalone project only working on essentially post-harvest issues.
As to your question concerning water tightness of hermetic storage, in this case cocoons, your surmise is entirely correct. If something is airtight, it's also watertight. A dramatic example occurred a few months ago in Mindanao as a result of a terrible cyclone where a warehouse full of grains was destroyed, all the grains spoiled except the few that were being stored in cocoons, which were perfectly intact after the effect of the cyclone. And in fact, we are beginning to market cocoons as flood resistant as an important aspect. I might add, you'll find some literature outside that I brought for those of you in the room who are interested in learning a little bit more.
We have a question from online.
Yeah, our first question is from Veronica Letellier from IRG and Gilly here in D.C. And it's a question for Steve. Can you talk about how climate change is impacting post-harvest activities and describe what are some of the adaptation options?
Okay. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes.
Okay, good. Climate, and as it comes about through weather, is and has been a key issue relative to post-harvest loss. And I'm going to kind of dodge the question by a way of saying, climate change and the variability of climate is just a big component of addressing post-harvest loss. And so I'm not so sure that we can point to a particular activity and say, oh, that was due to climate change, as we think about it in the popular media. And so our focus is on the climate and how it, or maybe weather events and how they are occurring, trying to be sensitive to understanding that what we may have observed in the last 40 years isn't the automatically the predictor of the next 10 years. So from the perspective of post-harvest loss, we're grappling with the weather and climate in, you know, wherever we're doing specific work, where anyone is doing specific work. So at least, so my thought is, I'm not saying climate change isn't important. It just continues to be important. And I don't see a specific, here or there. And part of this is, I don't want to get into the debate of is it climate change or not, because we have to deal with it, whatever it is. Is it man-made climate change or not? We have to deal with it. So I think our focus is more on understanding understanding the relation of weather and climate on post-harvest loss, but knowing that what we see today and what we've seen for the last 20 years isn't necessarily going to be what we're going to see for the next 10 years, which makes a problem, of course, much bigger. But that's how we think about climate change.
Rob Bertram. Question for Steve and a question for Philippe. Steve, I thought the comments you made about the low-latitude situations in a biophysical sense from India and Brazil, you know, are very interesting and relevant. I'm wondering, what would you speculate a little bit as to some of the challenges that we might encounter working in countries that are, say, less advanced in terms of their communications and transportation infrastructure? I'm thinking of sub-Saharan Africa in particular. I'd just be curious if you'd comment on that. And then, Philippe, I wonder, I don't think you mentioned rodents, and I'm curious to know about rodents and how they look at these hermetically sealed storage containers.
So I'll take the first part of that. One of the intriguing things about the low latitude and countries, and I made the comment about, you know, it's humid and hot, so storage is harder. Operationally, what we see in many instances, and one of the things that I didn't anticipate, was the pressure for the second and third crop. That the farmer's management perspective is, I need to get the field clear, and so that I can get the second or third crop in a optimal or good time period, because rains don't necessarily. Now I'm thinking of Brazil, where the rain for the safrina crop, the second crop, is very much at the planting time. And what that means is the farmer's time and attention is not focused on harvest and post-harvest loss storage, is focused on something else. So the low latitude is very interesting, and it's interesting beyond humidity. The interesting thing about technology is, and in the sub-Saharan is, and this is just an impression, is that particularly with respect to information communication technologies, the pace of change may be much more rapid than we anticipate. And particularly as the pace of change reduces the cost of technologies that are related to sensors and communications, I guess one of my lessons, or one of our lessons, is we need to suspend the perspective of a developing country being a low technology company as the world of ICT moves very rapidly, and major players, not necessarily in agriculture, have interest in that. So it's a bit of and at least my observation, my reaction to the question is, we need to know what's going on the ground, because it may be going much faster than one would think. Certainly one would think sitting here in central Illinois.
Robert, thank you for raising an important question. It's easy to forget when you have a solved problem that it's not obvious. In the case of cocoons, the tough PVC that is used has special tensioning straps. Why? If you have it taut, rodents can't get a tooth hold, and that solves the problem very elegantly throughout the world. In the case of super grain bags or grain safes, you have to protect as you would any other grain bag. And for that reason, we provide rodent guards. Any platform, you put rodent guard on each of the legs, and that does it, or you can hang the bag. We had in Guatemala, unfortunately, two failures because the user didn't put on the rodent guards, in which case the bags and the grain safes are fair game. But that emphasizes the importance of training, which we already know. And there are many ways of misusing technology, and you've just named one. Similarly in cocoons, if you don't use the tensioning straps, the results will not be good. So it's an excellent question. It's a solved problem when properly used.
Yeah, so this was sort of already answered online by Bob Robotsky, but he took a first stab at it, and we'd like to pass it on to the other presenters as well. This is from Dan Tuttle from Dahlberg Global Development Advisors in New York City. Are there any big forces in the market or among donors that you see accelerating the spread of these technologies at the farm level? And is it that technologies are hitting a new low price point, that they are better distribution networks, or that there's increased donor attention on post-harvest loss, or something entirely different? That could be for any of our presenters.
Well, I'll take a crack at it. Steve, you may want to add something. The question of reaching small farmers is a very important question. In the case of safe storage using hermetic technology, you cannot, as a commercial company, go and reach each farmer individually. So we have a number of means. International agencies, USAID, can foster programs where once you get it going, it then becomes self-perpetuating. That's what's being done in the Philippines by the Philippine government. Larger users can be reached through normal commercial channels, but the distribution problem is a major headache. This is why, although GrainPro is growing at 50% per year, it still is a drop in the bucket in terms of the worldwide need because of the challenges of distribution, including educating users to spend their hard-earned money to save a lot of money, but not the next morning.
So I'll comment this, Steve. I think the question is about increasing attention and interest, and one of the realities of mathematics is when, you know, your base is very, very small, you can have a lot of increase. And I remember a report from McKinsey about in 2011 that showed the amount of public attention devoted to food waste was infinitesimal relative to other potential sustainability. The activities important in the world. I do think I should point out, though, some very good work by agencies such as USAID and FAO in the last, say, 2 or 3 years that have really highlighted the magnitude at a regional, national, and international level. And I think those have been very good. And I think we've also seen an awareness that this is part of the sustainability problem. You know, it is not a food problem by itself. It is part of the larger sustainability problems. I think those have contributed to greater interest. But what we need, and this it seems to me, is we need to be generating evidence that will maintain the interest after we move past this what may be a bubble over the last couple of years of increased attention. How do we maintain that and build on that? I don't think we can take for granted that the rate of increase of attention that we've seen in the last couple of years is going to continue.
My name is Jordan Day, and I work with GrainPro here in Washington on food security issues. And I just wanted to respond quickly to the Dahlberg question, because I think there has been, what I've seen in the last 2 years, is a lot of public attention to the issue of post-harvest loss. And I think both Rob and John sort of mentioned that from a public policy perspective, it's been tough to figure out how to address it adequately. And the Rwanda program from USAID was a good example of that a couple years ago. That's ended. The World Bank has a poll project in place now, which is innovative. FAO has been doing some work. But really the role of government policy here is critical, and not just from a donor perspective, but also national governments. And Phil mentioned what the Philippines is doing, and it's really, we're going to generate a lot of good data, I think, from that. But it's government policy looking, in this case, at self-sufficiency in rice. But we need to see more, I think, innovative work in this area, more targeted work. And I think the Dahlberg question from New York goes right at the heart of that.
Hello, my name is Dorothy Taft with the Tintan Group here in the D.C. area. My first question, I think, would be best directed to Steve. And the question is there an opportunity for smaller NGOs who are involved in farm-to-market projects, particularly in the low latitudes, to participate in and contribute to the research that's being done? And how do they go about, you know, becoming a qualified participant in that research? I'm thinking about, you know, projects that, you know, may just be in other parts of the world, but if they knew what criteria you're needing and could contribute to that, it would be helpful to know. My second question is similar and directed probably to Philippe or Jordan here, and that is, what is GrainPro's business model that would include small NGOs working on farm-to-market projects? And are they potential purveyors of your product or trainers for your product if they happen to be working in areas that you're interested in spreading to? Thank you.
Okay, this is Steve. And very quickly, we continually want to expand our network of collaborators. And so in my PowerPoints, my email is there and our website is there. So please contact me. Let me know of your interest capabilities. And if there's a match with us or with other entities that we're working with, we'd be happy to pass that on. So, we are definitely looking to expand our network, and the best way I think to do that is just through email and our webpage.
Another excellent question. The answer is NGOs have a major role to play in dissemination. First, they are trusted partners in a number of countries, very important. We actually partner with about a dozen NGOs internationally and contractors. I myself spent a number of years on the board of Mercy Corps, and we see this alliance important both as participating in joint proposals, of which we have a number, and in terms of field experience and data. I cited the work of the Millennium Village study in Uganda. It's a perfect example of that kind of cooperation, and we look forward to a lot more, including local NGOs.
Just to add to that a bit, what we're seeing around the world, right, is that we, from a policy perspective, are asking smallholder farmers to take on quite a bit of risk, right, that we want them to invest in improved fertilizer. We want them to invest in high-yielding seeds. We want them to invest in better irrigation. Drip irrigation was mentioned today. We want them to invest in safe storage, pesticide-free storage. Those are all costs to the smallholder farmer. And if they don't have a place to sell that grain, we're asking them to sell into a market that is really, really dangerous for them. Into the mic, excuse me. So as Phil mentioned, we work with NGOs because we're talking about 500 million smallholder farmers around the world who are in the most remote areas, right? That's the only way a small company like GrainPro can access and work with them. But we're dealing with a complex issue here, as Stephen mentioned, and we really have to look at the amount of burden we're putting on the smallholder from our sort of Feed the Future and global agricultural development policy. And I'm completely supportive of Feed the Future, and I think we're moving absolutely in the right direction. But it's a lot of burden on the smallholder.
One final question.
Steve Kovac, USAID. This question's for Philip. In terms of your hermetic storage technology, what is the cost per kilogram or metric ton of product stored?
Another good question. The answer is it varies strongly as a function of size. It can be as low as $20 per ton stored in larger cocoons, and they have a 10 to 15 year life, so per year it can be as low as $2 and less. On the other hand, in the smaller sizes, it's more significant. In the case of the TransSafe lineups, which are for intercontinental travel, for instance, transport, it works out to a little over a cent per pound stored. So it varies over a broad range, and we realize that the degree of reuse is a key factor, which is one of the reasons why super grain bags also can be reused, but not a 10 to 15 year life. And one of the reasons why we're introducing this new product, the super grain bag Forte, which totally eliminates the cost of the outer bag and therefore literally pays for itself in many situations.
We have some final comments from John Bowman.
No, I just wanted to try to make a response to the earlier question about, you know, the activity levels of the donors in this space and some of the problems associated with that. I think that at least from, you know, our office in terms of research and policy, what we're trying to do is tee up appropriate technologies that are ultimately scalable. I mean, this whole area of trying to address the project in vast acreages of grain, unless we can find truly, you know, scalable solutions, we're not going to make too much progress. There's lots of tricks we have to combat the forces that are trying to, you know, ruin the post-harvest yields and the quality of our crops. We have, you know, hermetic solutions. We have grain solar dryers. We have better varieties. It seems to me what's not getting attention is just the basics of kind of harvest drying, sorting, drying, you know, before we, you know, getting the crop properly prepared to put into some kind of a tricky and efficient storage system we have that may or may not be economically suitable for smallholder farmers. For the last 20 years, we can't get farmers in Africa, many in Asia, to properly dry the crop, despite, you know, millions, maybe billions of dollars invested. I mean, that's, and so, you know, why has that failed? I mean, that's a question I constantly have about. It's a very simple solution. You can't, you know, you'll be unhappy with the performance of your product if that grain doesn't go in there properly.
It doesn't work, period.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all. And so it's, you know, I'm, you know, relatively, in my other experiences, relatively new to this area as to why we can't kind of crack that basic nut of basic, it's knowledges and practices. It's to properly, you know, prepare grains and vegetable crops for the post-harvest phase. There's a huge gap there. There's a huge need for investment there. In particular, our office is probably not working as much in that area. We're more focused on teeing up technologies that are ultimately have the highest degree of potential for scaling. But that problem lurks huge, you know, before it gets to the technology development and dissemination of just the working with the farmers in terms of best knowledges and practices on very simple things like drying. And that's where I see a huge problem. And I don't see... I see kind of a donor disinterest in that at this current point in time, that Rwanda project, I think, properly addressed that issue, working with hundreds of farmers and cooperatives on some of the basics. And as to, again, I repeat, as to why we don't have 10 of those kind of projects under Feed the Future, you know, baffles me. Enough said.
Okay, with that, I'd like to thank our speakers, John, Phil, and Steve, for joining us today, and Steve from joining us all the way from snowy Illinois. Thank you very much.